Well, sincere thanks to each of our three presenters. And Your Holiness, you've been hearing about the effects of stress, particularly early stress on the brain and multiple bodily systems, their relationship to disease, and some of the things often based on mindfulness kinds of practices that might be able to change this for the better. And we wonder about whether, from your perspective, you think there are more important, or what are the most important of social or relationship factors that can influence well-being as we grow, reach adulthood and age?
It's very difficult to generalize in these kind of situations. So His Holiness was saying that maybe, you know, he would expect to see differences from individual to individual. In some cases, you know, because of some genetic inheritance or whatever, there may be situations where, if as a result of adverse stress in early childhood, the damage could be so severe that it probably there is no possibility of reversing it. So generally speaking, yeah.
I have one question. My own sort of curiosity. You mentioned jet lag.
Jet lag.
This is for me. You see, time zone change.
Oh yes,
No disturbance about my sleep.
Okay.
No, it's a new place. Now, for example, from Delhi up to here, 9 hours differences. But then reach here, set up, is local time. Then local time, about 6:37, I feel asleep. Then next morning, around three, wake up. No problem. Now the stomach clock.
That's true.
Won't listen.
Yeah.
No?
Yes.
So, time change. Then this system, irregular. So, seems to see, sleep, although physical sort of what's today, kasoda,
elements involved,
but seems to see some closer connection with mind, mental.
Yep.
So mental level, set of time, then sleep goes according to their time. The physical won't be about mind. Its own sort of kasoda, independent sort of clock or something like that.
Right.
So do you think some sort of kasoda? The scientific research.
Is there any scientific explanation for this?
Well, the cortisol rise is what is
organized by our circadian clock, the clock in our brain, and actually all cells of the body, that actually has to be shifted so that we can adjust to a different time zone. And that clock, early in the morning, is, among other things, turning on our cortisol secretion, so it goes up, and it actually gets us hungry for our breakfast, and it makes us more active. So it's part of that which gets us ready for the next day. Now, that only really changes. You can make it change more rapidly by exposure of the head to bright sunlight. Some people think melatonin is a chemical that we can, a hormone that we can use. But that really is the important biological element that needs time to shift in the right way.
So his holiness's question is this. His sleep cycle seems
right.
to
and the sleep cycle
seems to
seem
be more
to
be amenable
more.
To his own.
And also related to the brain. Oh.
Right. And that, yeah, I mean, I think as long as your stomach isn't growling too much, then you may be able to get a normal night's sleep. I'm not able to offer an explanation other than the fact, as you said yourself, that there is a higher cognitive process that enables you to make that sleep process occur independently of these other physiologic
issues.
I don't think our stomachs are as smart as our brains.
That's so less complicated. This is very complicated.
We do mind training, not stomach training.
Your Holiness, I'd like to ask of you, each of the speakers made reference to training based upon mindfulness. In the traditions in which meditation has been practiced, it's always been a part of other things as well. From your perspective, is mindfulness or meditation practice enough, or must there be other things that go along with it?
So, of course, there are different forms of practices such as mindfulness and shamatha, which tends to operate more on the level of application of attention. So they are more cognitively oriented and mental. However, there are other practices which are less mental, but more involves application of
I think this morning
energy.
I mentioned mind is also because the ability is knowing. Then energy carry movement. So it's two ways. Control destructive emotion on the level of mind itself. It's a training try to familiarize loving kindness, these things. Then the anger, these reduce. This is one way. Then another, since anger also is combined with certain energy, so you see, try to control the energy, the intensity of anger reduce. Different way. So here, the yoga training.
So the second part of the approach is more kind of yoga based and more kind of physiological processes.
Physical exercise.
For example, in your example, you talked about the elderly walking for an hour. So that effect is really coming from the more physiological route than mental.
I would like to carry on examination. two persons, more or less same age, 1 hour long, walk. One, during walk, there's a lot of anger. Another, 1 hour walk, more sort of peaceful,
calm state.
Because of that.
Calm state of mind.
Calm state of mind. Then what differences?
Well, it's possible also that the walking may calm that one person down, possibly. But also, I think you bring up a very important point, because if one forces somebody to walk, it does not have the benefits for brain function that voluntarily walking, and I think your point about what's going on in the mind is very important. But the other aspect of this, in the best possible state where one is voluntarily walking, physically active, does it open up the brain, facilitate the plasticity of the brain, and then does it make mindfulness and other practices more effective? That was actually going to be one of the questions I was going to ask you, because we regard these things as facilitators.
That's very true. In fact, in the tradition, there is a recognition that, for example, switching from a more agitative state of mind directly onto a more wholesome state is, you know, not possible. So in order to get to
very
a more
difficult.
Very difficult. So to move on
not
to
not possible though, more... yeah.
Yes.
I think someone who something very familiar, you see these things, then within seconds you can shift.
It's shift now. So it's
but more difficult. Ordinary people.
So ordinary people it's more difficult. So you need an intervening period where that you from the agitated, disturbed state of mind, you try to get to a more neutral state of mind and then move on to a wholesome state of mind. And this transitional kind of process is generally affected through some form of exercises, so which in the tradition would include a specific breathing, active breathing exercises to get you to that state and then move on to meditation practices.
One of the implications of what Bruce is saying is that a number of the methods that have been found to produce changes in the brain are methods that induce increased plasticity. But increased plasticity in and of itself is neither necessarily good or bad. It depends on what that plasticity is being used for. When stressful experiences occur, it's through plasticity that the brain can be changed in a negative way. And I think one of the interesting implications of Bruce's question is there may be methods like walking which may induce plasticity, may increase plasticity, and if it is combined with a practice that cultivates a wholesome state of mind, that may actually be particularly beneficial, and it may actually help the cultivation of a healthy state of mind to also be engaged in a strategy which at the same time promotes plasticity, because it would increase the opportunity for learning.
Right, absolutely.
So this actually ties back to what I'd like to request of Al for a further clarification of what you meant by other things. Because I'm not clear whether we were talking about different specific meditation practices, or you are actually pointing to a much larger question, which has to do with an ethical framework and a kind of spiritual worldview in which to situate a commitment to contemplative practice. Was that what the other things
yes,
were?
Both. Both.
Okay, so that is a different...
To respond to this more specific question about kind of, in other words, decontextualizing these kind of practices from their sources, His Holiness was making the point that, for example, if you look at the role of faith and the importance of faith in different traditions, you see kind of a certain universality. The object of the faith may be different to whom, you know, you cultivate that faith. And the sources from which this faith arises may be different. In some individuals, it arises out of understanding, through reason, critical reflection. In some, it would be more of a devotional, you know, kind of approach. But in the faith itself is a mental state. And it can be independent from any specific sources from which it arises. So similarly, and these meditation practices may, you know, come from certain cultural kind of milieu, and you take it out of context, but in themselves, there can be a universality. So His Holiness was saying that he often cited the example of the principle of dependent or interdependence, which in its philosophical formulation really comes most mainly in the Buddhist sources. But the principle of interdependence can be applied, you know, in other secular domains, such as environment. So in itself, it's a kind of a more universal principle. So from where it comes from and its universality, you know, maybe, you know, so one can see that way.
It's really interesting that the first word that enters in this dialogue is faith, because that's not a word we often hear when we're talking about mindfulness.
So it's just an example.
But it may be very critical to have, in fact, a sense of strong belief in the inquiry, a faith that the practice is actually going to be fruitful.
I think millions of scientists cause of very more laboratory research, meva, the passage, Rishi. Register jiggy, thoroughly investigate Chesaneta, Casorpe, Tupunjikoshevita, Yishendro.
I mean, faith does play a role, His Holiness is saying that there are thousands of scientists out there, and not every of them is going to repeat every single fact that they are going to subscribe to.
I didn't say that faith is not
true. They will subscribe to someone like Richie's word and trust him. For
so some form of faith is there.
faith in the data.
This is different. Yeah. No, that different aspect of it. Yeah. Faith is different aspect. Oh. Yeah. I think children, you see, listen. The parents, good parents, advice. Simply faith.
It's trust. I think problem trust. Is coming from the English translation. The term is sometimes trust and sometimes faith. That was it.
The easy. Long. Easy, trust. Faith with trust. Another, faith, desire.
In the form of an admiration, in the form of aspiration. Wanting to achieve that.
Another sort of faith,
in the form of admiration.
So different.
Your Holiness, there is a development.
So His Holiness was saying that his usage of the word faith was not entirely out of context.
I was just going to mention that part of this, there's a well-known developmental psychologist at Stanford who has studied a children's capacity or children's belief or faith in the changeability of their own mind. And it turns out that if a child believes that she or he could change, their capacity to change is dramatically enhanced.
So even where the route that we go through critical reason, critical inquiry, at the end of the critical inquiry, you need to trust what you discover.
Actually, you see, aim is some kind of conviction. Conviction which goes very well with reality. Mm-hmm. Some conviction based on appearances. So that conviction is dangerous. We must know the reality thoroughly. Then is the firm sort of conviction. That's that kind of conviction based on reason, investigation. Now I think that those well-known, genuine, open-minded scientists years investigate. Through their investigation, their finding is now something definite. Trust.
So this is something that we can trust.
So Deva. Deva sort of is conviction.
Conviction.
Everyone, I want to make sure we reserve enough time for Your Holiness to make closing comments. But I also wanted to be able to ask Mathieu a question. It's very clear what contemplatives have contributed to the science that we've been talking about. But I'm curious about what it is that the science has contributed, if anything at all, to contemplatives.
So,
His Holiness is saying that one of the Tibetan Buddhist practices involved repeating 100,000. It's a part of the preliminary practice where you repeat the mandala offering, which is offering of the cosmos, which is based on the Abhidhamma cosmology of mind Meru centered with a earth, flat earth. So then you repeat that formula 100,000 times. So His Holiness was saying that one of the benefits is the casualty of that cosmology.
Because I got it.
So His Holiness was saying that actually once when he spoke about his own lack of, you know, sort of faith in the Abhidhamma cosmology, which is Mount Meru centered, and how he does not accept that anymore. And then one, you know, person actually asked him, in that case, you don't believe it, in that case, is there no benefit in making mandala offering ritual? So he responded that the point of making a mandala offering is to offer the entire cosmos. So regardless of whether they are owned or unowned, everything, so still there will be benefits. So it's not only the exposure to modern cosmology and astronomy that question the veracity of the Abhidhamma, Mount Meru-centered cosmos, but in fact, even independent of exposure to contemporary cosmology, even within the Buddhist resources, if you look at the description of the cosmos in very different texts, there are conflicting accounts of the cosmos. So they're all talking about the same reality, but they are conflicting accounts. And furthermore, you know, in the Buddhist philosophy, we often use epistemological and logical arguments, forms of argument, where by observing facts that are contrary to certain phenomena, you can then disprove certain claims. And similarly, in some context, non-observance can be a proof of its absence. So when in relation to critiquing others' position, classical Buddhist texts use these... observance of contrary facts and non-observance. So since we use these forms of logic and reasoning when critiquing others' standpoint, you cannot then pretend that your own position is immune to that kind of reasoning. So through these methods too, you know, one can question the veracity of the Abhidhamma cosmos.
What about the contemplative science as it's grown over the last 20 years, given this collection of efforts and the interest in the room, the distributed consequences of all of the studies of contemplative practice, how is that benefiting the tradition?
So His Holiness was saying that he often makes distinctions between three kind of broad elements on the contents of the classical Buddhist sources. On the one element has to do with understanding the nature of reality. So there is an element of science in the Buddhist texts as well, whether it is related to external cosmos or the nature of mind or mental processes.
Or particle. So,
or even particle.
Quantum physics.
Particle physics and so on, on the one hand. So that has to do with the description of the understanding of nature of reality. So, and then the second element has to do with Buddhist philosophy, which is an understanding, an inquiry into the ultimate nature of reality. And then based upon these two...
Not only ultimate reality, but also now, for example, the concept of impermanence.
So the reasoning and inquiry into the philosophical dimensions. And then based upon these two, then there is the Buddhist practice and religion. So, and because of this, through the dialogue with scientists, in the area of understanding the physical universe, of course, the Buddhist side benefits tremendously because of the sophistication in the scientific understanding. And then in the mental domain, Buddhism probably has quite a lot to offer to contemporary science. And looking at the contemplative research, one thing that the Buddhists can gain from this is to really an understanding the efficacy of some of these practices, so that at least at the individual level, meditators can feel we are not wasting our time. And His Holiness was saying that otherwise, people who commit themselves to three-year retreat may start to doubting, does this really work?
Then,
you know, otherwise they become kind of self-imposed prisons. Prisoners.
Mathieu, do you wish to add anything to that?
Well, you know, in the beginning, I was, when some of our scientist colleagues were asking me, you know, how does that change the way you practice in your hermitage? And I was trying to be polite, but in the very beginning, certainly, I mean, I knew what kind of practice my teachers have taught me. So I was not basically, when I was going back to my hermitage, I was basically following the traditional course of practice and didn't change much. I didn't change my schedules or my way of practicing. But there are some insights, definitely, which gradually I gained from this collaboration on related directly to the practice. And just to give you a very short example, you know, in modern psychology, we speak of loving kindness, of empathy, which is, of course, there are many definitions, but one of them, especially in neuroscience, is affective resonance. If someone is joyful, you feel very happy. If someone is very sad, there's some element of sadness. It was shown in the brain that if you see pain and you resonate with the pain area in the brain is activated. This is actually also your pain. So the question was for compassion, which is, compassion is supposed to be loving, the love applied to suffering, the wish that may suffering and the cause be removed. Do you need to feel, now I remember Paul Ekman insistently asking me, do you need to feel the suffering of others or not? And it was a bit puzzling because sometimes the sight of suffering is extremely moving, and sometimes some of our teachers, like Kenshin Moshe, who His Holiness knew very well, when he was told about very sad news, you could see that a very great depth, incredible depth of compassion, but you would not see a strong emotional display on his face. So we were totally convinced personally that his compassion was immense, but he would not show extreme display of sadness or whatever. So it may vary. So I was thinking, how can we better understand and reply to the scientists? So once I was with Tanya Singer, who is another neuroscientist who is part of the Board of Mind and Life, and we were trying to see if we could make it differently. So first of all, when I was trying to meditate on compassion, in the scanner, she was looking at what's going on, and we were doing so-called real-time fMRI, when you can see, and she says, what are you doing? This is not what we usually see when someone empathizes with someone suffering. So then we talked more, and we said, well, maybe the sort of resonance with suffering is what triggers compassion, but maybe compassion has another dimension. So now, how to distinguish those, which we don't necessarily do in the hermitage, is say, well, let's do for 1 hour just empathic resonance with suffering. So I was remembering some very dramatic images I had seen the day before on the BBC of orphan from the from the Romanian place where they were so weak, they were barely taken care, even walking sometimes, they would break their bones, they were sitting like that. Extreme sufferings, images of people trapped in earthquakes. So I did that for a whole hour, trying to just feel that, focused on that, and not, you know, try to bring the loving kindness and compassion, almost pushing it away as far as it's possible, but just really focus again and again on the suffering. And within an hour, I felt like this was unbearable. I mean, the what we call burnout, that means the emotional sort of weariness and exhaustion that comes from resonating with suffering that caregivers might have day after day after day, and we know that 60% of doctors and nurses have this burnout. They cannot stand it anymore. So sometimes they choose to distance themselves, which is of course not the right solution, because if you become cold emotionally, you basically treat patients as client or whatever, so it's like the human dimension. So then at the end of this 1 hour, our friend Tanya Singer said, we want to take a lunch break or you want to start, you know, the compassion aspect. I said, please, I want to start the compassion. This is too much, you know, this feeling of distress. So that's why I was a bit puzzled by that. And then when sort of I tried the best I could to generate, you know, embracing love and compassion and human warmth and loving kindness, of trying to pervade the suffering with love and compassion, I felt completely different. Instead of this sort of anxiety and deep sort of discomfort, I feel more like all embracing with a very positive attitude, like a mother will take a sick child and try to comfort him. So a very, very different state of mind. And then in the brain, it was obviously very different. I mean, areas which had to do with anxiety, like the amygdala, were turned off. There's some areas which has to do with what they call rewards. I would not call it reward myself, but a very wholesome state of mind were activated, positive emotions. So then come the idea, could we use that for, you know, caregivers? So there's a long study that's going to go on, but to make it short, a preliminary study showed if you take anyone, you know, two groups and separate them randomly, and one will do just trying to do this empathy training for 1 week. After 1 week, they reported that they were seeing suffering everywhere, even going at the workplace. They saw suffering all over the place, to the extent that it was actually affecting them. And we had to add 1 day of loving kindness training to put the balance back. But the group that did just loving kindness, when there they were exposed to suffering, they saw not positively, but with positive emotions and sense of courage rather than discouragement. So in a way, that study with so what we call meditators or practitioners, that we try to figure out how those two relate. That was also new for us. And just to conclude, in the teachings we say that we must contemplate the suffering of the beings, and then there is unbearable, like misopa. And so, but maybe before bringing the compassion, maybe we should do a little bit more extended so that we really feel strongly the unbearable aspect of suffering, and then the compassion will be probably much more genuine, much greater than just thinking of suffering and immediately sort of wishing that the suffering may be out. So that's one element, for instance, which I became much more clear to my limited understanding by interacting with the research.
Thank you, Mathieu.
Yeah. Dungele Chana Samelodi, yeah, Jidanish, Dungele Dandu Lodge. 다티 동물의 차투야게 땡수게 매체 다 동물의 차투야게 땡수 요등이 인질에 있으잖아요 경적인 인질사들 다티 닝도 사고도 다 심부스도 가 저상 갖고 치즈하고 동물 통한 대수기 닝도 파르마도 닝도 중요한 매체지
So what Mathula said is really very true. Therefore, in the Buddhist sources, when we read about compassion, there are many different kinds of compassion mentioned. For example, there is the simple compassion elicited by the sight of others suffering. And there are other forms of compassion where the compassion is reinforced by the wisdom component of understanding that, you know, certain reality of that situation. And even we speak of non-objectifying or non-referential compassion, where the compassion is very strong, but it has no element of grasping or, you know, clinging. So these are descriptions of compassion from the point of view of different complementary factors. But even in the compassion itself, one can speak of two types of compassion. One is a simple wish to see the object of your concern to be free from suffering. The other one is a more courageous form of compassion where actually not only you wish the person to be free, but you want to bring that about, the elevation of suffering. So this second level of compassion has a much greater sense of courage and you wanted to do something. And in this second type of compassion, you know, the more you're exposed to suffering, the greater courage you acquire. Instead of being overwhelmed and distressed, you know, the sight of suffering enhances your courage and the wish to do something about it.
Thank you.
So, of course, it's easy to talk about them, but it's very difficult to actually experience and cultivate them.
Your Holiness, I know you must leave quite soon. But I wonder whether you have some closing comments, things you would like to say before you have to depart for the day.
Kim, no, I know nothing. I really enjoy, and I always say, enjoy this kind of meeting. It's actually education for myself. Then sometimes, while I was explaining, experts, you see, explain their own sort of field.
Research lab.
So while I listen, there's some questions as they come. Then, when the presentation finished, all these questions disappear. And I'm quite lazy to make note. So in any way, whenever I participate in this kind of meeting, I really learned many new things, useful things. So thank you very much. And those people. I usually say mentioning this kind of sort of research work, two aims. One aim, simply our understanding about reality. Our scientific sort of research expand. Till recent, the modern science, their field, mainly physical field, physical world, not much pay attention about inner world. Now like this, and these people are really now showing more interest about our inner world. It is necessary, our health, happy family, happy society, global level, happy humanity. Ultimately, it leads with our inner peace, inner value. So they now, I think, carry research, scientists carry research work more holistic. That's wonderful. So knowledge extend.
Expand.
That's one thing. Another thing, from our knowledge, from our findings, how can we contribute for a better world, happier world? I think from religious sort of side, I think last, I think almost 4,000 years, religious side, they try to improve humanity. But some benefit, but overall humanity is concerned, I think I may say fail. So now, the modern science, I think should fill where the madanti.
Fill where there is a gap.
Oh, I just mentioned when separate education institutions started in the European continent about 1,000 years ago. At that time, the moral ethics take care by church. So more or less balance. So a newly established education institution taking care only brain. Now, the influence of church little reduced. And also the society becoming more multi-religious sort of community. Or look, humanity, then multi-religious humanity. So logically, religion now cannot cover, any religion cannot cover
entire humanity.
So we must find new way to approach these moral ethics. And that also, you see, oh, such sort of person, you see, stated, and we must believe that. It's a wrong approach. We must prove through scientific sort of, because of the research.
Research.
Then the data, it's like this presentation, is really convincing. That based on these things, then educate people from kindergarten up to university level about moral ethics. That, I think, another sort of purpose or goal of our meeting. Then we really makes a contribution for a better world from your sort of marvelous knowledge out of research work. And then very good. Otherwise, you see, all those knowledge, you see, keep here and then eventually buried in coffin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.